Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It is nice to be here. It is the 21st of July, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. We have a lot to talk about, and we will get right to that. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. I mentioned this yesterday, but one of the things that we notice is that the letters are tending to be much longer than normal. Don't do that. Just make them a little shorter would be great. Short and to the point and on topic. I know that because Sarah highlighted that in blue. All right. No links, no attachments, and that's all we ask. Otherwise, have fun, enjoy, and we'll meet you in Chicago. Let us introduce everybody to you, and we'll get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here.
Hey.
We don't have your mic on. We'll get your mic on.
Oh,
there no. You go. Go ahead.
I said, hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good, as things go, I'm pretty good.
Good. Excellent. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is here. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
Good.
Hey.
Lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. There seems to be a theme of saying very little, so...
You know there doesn't have to be.
No,
break it. Break the wall.
Let's keep it going all the way through the show. Make Joe's job a little
one
harder.
One word for you, Terry. Manifesto. Go. Let's go. Chairman of the Capital District Latinos, Dan Rosario, is with us. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. Let's get started and talk about what is happening in the news. And again, we welcome your letters on all of these topics. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, we begin with, there are competing stories in the Washington Post and New York Times. I think that's it's interesting, but the Washington Post has a story that says that a growing number of Republicans urge vaccinations amid Delta surge. The headline on the New York Times article as virus starts to surge, GOP continues reluctance. So I guess they're both true, right? Mm.
Yeah, I had seen McConnell coming out and Joe and making a statement that everybody ought to get vaccinated, and I said, boy, they're scared of something now because they may have said it in passing, but this is a concentrated push. So they must see something coming that is making them nervous and coming out and doing what they have to do, which is to say everybody ought to get vaccinated, and nothing could be truer than that everybody ought to get vaccinated.
But you reap what you sow, and for a year plus, they have poo-pooed this virus. So here's the Washington Post take on it. A growing number of Republicans urge vaccinations amid the Delta surge. Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, as Alan mentioned, was part of a rising chorus on Tuesday stressing the need for unvaccinated Americans to receive coronavirus shots and warning that the country could reverse its progress in moving on from the pandemic. These shots need to get in everybody's arms as rapidly as possible, or we're going to be back in a situation in the fall where we don't yearn for that we went through last year, McConnell said during his weekly news conference. I want to encourage everybody to do that and ignore all of these other voices that are giving demonstrably bad advice. Well, the problem is that much of that bad advice is coming from Republicans and conservative voices who are saying that the virus is a hoax. The remarks from McConnell, though, then followed comments in recent days from other Republicans and from conservative voices urging people to get vaccinated, even as other members of the GOP continued to sound notes of skepticism and spread misinformation about the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. Among the most notable voices was Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, the number two Republican in House leadership, who received his first dose of Pfizer vaccine over the weekend let that sink in, and urged others to follow suit. Scalise had long resisted vaccination, claiming protection from antibodies and saying earlier this year that he wanted to ensure his constituents had a chance to be vaccinated first. So meanwhile, there is the skepticism that continues over the Delta variant, Amid a widening partisan divide over coronavirus vaccination, most Republicans have either stoked or ignored the flood of misinformation reaching their constituents and instead focused their message about the vaccine on disparaging President Biden, characterizing his drive to inoculate Americans as politically motivated and heavy-handed. Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas pointed the finger at the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki and the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Every time Jen Psaki opens her mouth or Dr. Fauci opens his mouth, he said, 10,000 more people say I'm never going to take the vaccine. Some elected Republicans are the ones spreading the falsehoods. Representative Jason Smith of Missouri warned on Twitter of KGB-style agents knocking on the doors of unvaccinated Americans, a reference to Mr. Biden's door-to-door vaccine outreach campaign. Such statements and the widespread silence by Republicans in the face of vaccine skepticism are beginning to alarm some strategists and party leaders, especially as the numbers continue to rise. Alan.
Well, I think I've said what I have to say, which is these people are political. They see what's coming. They see that they're going to get blamed for it, and they want out. They want out of the way. The fact is that most Americans are getting the message, and the message is, you know, you really do need to get vaccinated in order to prevent your ill health and that of your children and grandchildren. I mean, it's pretty clear now that there is only one way to go here, and that is to get vaccinated. Now, there are people who write to me and they tell me, this is a democracy, we can do whatever we want. Yeah, you could die. But to me, this is pretty clear.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think Alan's right about the notion that they're concerned about a potential backlash if this continues to spread and you know, we end up going back into kind of lockdown modes or whatever that nobody wants to see. And I mean, I think there would be a voters who are pretty angry and motivated by that. And I think that's a risk that, you know, McConnell is famously always looking ahead. I think that's something that he's concerned about. I think those of us who pay a lot of attention to politics and who follow this stuff pretty closely, I think we probably overestimate how much political leaders, how impact they have. I mean, McConnell saying that, urging people to get vaccinated is a nice gesture, but it's not going to make any significant difference. I mean, I don't think the people who are heavily resistant to the vaccine care much what politicians think. I don't think that, I don't think that's where they get their information about these sorts of things.
Well, though, there is a difference between McConnell saying it and if Trump said it, right?
I think Trump has said it, though. Hasn't he urged people to get vaccinated at least twice?
Let's put it this way. You're right, Chris, in passing. But this is not what I would call a, you know, full-throated, endorsement of the idea. Look, we know about Trump. Anything that's good for Biden or anything that Biden's getting credit for, Trump doesn't want anything to do with. But what's interesting to me is he doesn't want his troops doing anything either. So if a McConnell comes along, that's perfidy as far as Trump is concerned, I believe.
Dan.
Well, there's a saying in Spanish, and it goes something like this. I'll say it in Spanish first for the benefit of those who are bilingual in your audience. No es lo mismo llamar al diablo que verlo venir. It's not the same thing to call the devil and see him coming down the road. I think how this applies is all these people who have resisted for so long and have been not weighed in for fear of backlash from the former president are seeing their constituents die. They're probably getting calls from people in their districts saying, you know, this thing is really turning ugly. So you have, you know, some people like Scalise who are finally deciding to look out for their constituents for a change instead of trying to hew to the orthodoxy of the former president. I think we shouldn't diminish the fact that this is important that they do so, but I also think that it's not going to mean a whole hell of a lot if local legislators, people like in the state house in Tennessee, where they're trying to stop even messaging to young people to get the vaccine or any vaccine, if those folks don't start ringing the alarm, then it's not going to be as effective as Mitch McConnell, you know, muttering on the floor of the Senate.
Terry.
Well, I look back at how this all started, and I find it interesting that from the very beginning, Republicans have really led the way in putting out disinformation and really not putting a full-throated support behind getting vaccinations, starting with Donald Trump. And I'm concerned now that we have some Republicans coming around that it's too little too late, and I don't think that their voices now will really hold a lot of influence. I think what they did or did not do early on is what really influenced their supporters. I would disagree with Chris slightly in that I do think politicians do have a great deal of influence over certain individuals.
Says the former politician.
but I mean, they're in the same category as all thought leaders. You know, whether it be a minister, whether it be a community leader, a business leader, I think politicians are in that category that can influence people. And I think their lack of support of the vaccines did influence millions of people not to get the vaccine early on. And I'm not sure you can go back and change that
exactly.
Now. And so I'm concerned that it's going to be ineffective. And I do think we have to hold them accountable for their lack of participation in helping move this forward. It's ridiculous that we're here. I mean, you see in that same Washington Post article that Joe mentioned that less than 50% of Republicans in the House of Representatives in the United States of America have been vaccinated today. That's unacceptable. And so I think we have to hold them accountable for where we are right now.
I would agree with you that that's unacceptable. I mean, that number really jumped out at me, too. But I would disagree with your history a little bit. I mean, back when Donald Trump was still president, it was Democrats who were questioning the safety of vaccines, of these very same vaccines, right? It was Andrew Cuomo who was saying the FDA process seemed reckless. It was Kamala Harris who said she wouldn't get the shot if it was approved under Donald Trump. So, I mean, there's a history of this that goes back before the vaccines were even, and that rhetoric, I don't think it just goes away. I think people who are vaccine hesitant or resistant do remember some of that stuff.
Yeah, I've heard, obviously I hear that argument, and I know that argument exists, but I don't quite understand it, because that was coming also at a time as the same people who were questioning the Operation Warp Speed were also very much acknowledging the existence of coronavirus and that it was killing people and thousands of people. And that was not happening on the Republican side as much, but, if at all.
But I think Chris's point is an interesting one. How do you get them back when they have committed themselves to following their leadership? Are they going to be angry? The rank and file, you know, are they going to be angry? What are they going to do? Will we be able to turn them around? This is, as it has been written several times this week, a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Yeah, I think the pandemic of the unvaccinated, what it really speaks to is a lack of trust. There are so many Americans have lost trust in almost any institution, you know, media, health, government. That's why I don't think Mitch McConnell coming out and saying, you know, get vaccinated will mean very much. But I do think that you have to look back at it. I mean, both sides have been undermining that trust for a very long time. And I think the statements by the governor and Kamala Harris back last fall do stick around. They don't just go away. And I completely agree that this is a phenomenon among Republican politicians at the moment. But what if Donald Trump had won re-election? Could we have seen the exact opposite, where it was Democrats who were vaccine hesitant and Republicans who were gung-ho? I don't know.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it seems difficult to believe. Terry?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think through that scenario. It's hard to envision that. I had forgotten about those comments that the governor made early on. But that was at a time when Donald Trump's administration seemed to be in charge of implementing the vaccine process, And there was, I think, reason to be hesitant about whether or not we could trust it. And so I think that was a natural evolution that had to take place. I mean, I think we've come around to where people that understand that we got through polio, we got through smallpox, we got through the measles and mumps, all of those things through vaccinations that our country has a history of having overcome these types of things. I think they've come around to appreciate that we can trust this vaccine as something we should do. It's that percentage of people that have fallen into the conspiracy theories that I think the Republican Party and Donald Trump have given air to constantly that have created this dilemma that we're in now, and getting them out of that conspiracy theory, I think, is going to take more than Mitch McConnell and other politicians coming forward and changing their tune.
So Cuomo in mid-November said that the FDA approvals have been done on an expeditious, if not reckless, basis, and then also said it's going to be a very skeptical American public about taking the vaccine, and they should be. The vaccines were ready a month later. I mean, these are the very same vaccine. I mean, and, you know, obviously his tone has shifted now, but I don't think that kind of rhetoric goes away. And I'm not blaming Andrew Cuomo for low vaccination rates, and New York's vaccination rates are actually pretty good. But I was just, you know, this kind of sowing mistrust in the FDA and in institutions goes back further than just the last few months.
It was very Cuomo-esque, if you think about it, you know, shoot from the hip.
Said that actually after the election, too. Yeah. I mean, he knew at that point that Biden was coming in.
Yeah. Well, he wanted to hold on to
him. I think it's got...
Yeah. So go ahead.
I think it's got a lot more to do with religious leaders. If you look at some of the places where there's such extreme vaccine hesitancy, and I'm not talking about dividing the vaccine hesitant into subgroups, but if you look at the states where this is happening, there are states who are voted for Trump, but also have, you know, they're kind of like in the Bible Belt, a lot of them. And I think that you have a large contingent of pastors in some of these churches who are, you know, God is going to protect you. No letters, please. I believe in God, and religion is a very personal thing for people. And I'm not trying to denigrate anybody who believes in that, but if you have congregations of vast numbers of people and you're telling them, you know, this is the government trying to enlist you, this is the, you know, mark of the beast is going to be given to you through a vaccine.
Dan, I have to pause for a break real quick, but I'll come to you as soon as we come back on the other side. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, and Dan Irizarry. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We do have a number of letters. Let's get to them. We'll work our way through. Ellen says, my experience in the Peace Corps in the 1970s mirrored Malcolm Nance's in the military. The week before we shipped out, we were vaccinated for everything possible, including yellow fever, tetanus, and ouch, rabies. There was no discussion about it, nor did we expect one. It was simply an accepted necessity. I miss those days. To everyone hesitating now, I say, grow up, shut up, and get your bleeping shots. Thank you for staying on all of this. Well, I think there's a difference between sending people over to corners of the world and in this situation where the shot has yet to be considered what's the official term, non-emergency, right?
I'm not sure there's a difference. I mean, you know, you're still walking around in society, whether you're here or over there.
No, I agree, but there's a difference of whether you can mandate it or not.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Well, I do think we should mandate this.
Me too.
I think it should be done, and I think it should have been done a long time ago, and I think it's ultimately the only way we're ever going to resolve this at this point in time.
To Joe's point, how do you mandate a vaccine that hasn't been approved by the FDA, or is approved only on an emergency basis?
Well, I do think the FDA needs to get to that step. I would agree that needs to be resolved. But once that's done, there doesn't seem to be any
Then, you know, you get into a question, how do you enforce something like that? I mean, there's almost no way to do it unless you're going to go door to door with, you know— and you think the conspiracy theories are rampant now. Wait till it happens when you force everybody to do it.
Yeah, but we, you know, with smallpox and polio and all these other things we had to do when we were kids, you know, it is hard to enforce. But once it becomes mandated, most people want to be law-abiding citizens,
sure.
and we'll do it. And so there's still going to be that small percentage, but it'll be a much smaller percentage than we have now that's not doing it.
No, that's right. Once the government steps in and says, we think you ought to do it, there'll be people who do it. You know, I got to tell you, there will be people, there'll be resistors, but fewer of them.
And let's bring up this point. I mean, I think this is really troubling because I don't think we know what's going on yet. But just over the last week, I mean, I think we saw this with the stock market on Monday. A lot of people who are vaccinated are coming down and being diagnosed with COVID, and that is a much higher number than I think we expected. Even that the rate would say of that it's 93% effective, and that has to be cause for concern, especially if those vaccinations, and the one that seems to be most questionable, sorry, Chris, is Johnson & Johnson against the Delta variant. And then, oh, by the way, we have more variants coming down the road, Lambda being identified in this country for the first time yesterday.
And the Delta is supposed to be 1,000, I think I heard on NPR, 1,000 times more
aggressive.
This is where I think the CDC... and I guess even the FDA to some degree, but I really think the CDC has really not done an effective job of communicating from the very beginning. And they have constantly changed their message. They've been contradictory. They've confused people. They haven't given us enough information. And I do think that we, the American people, should hold the CDC accountable and our government accountable for being better communicators and giving us the information that we need to make the choices that we need to make to protect ourselves. And I think that with the lack of that, we continue to live in this state of unknown, and it allows these controversies to really thrive.
And Walensky, I think, to some degree, has not been the stable force that she ought to be. I mean, she's changed her mind a couple of times.
Yeah.
She frankly freaked out at some point, and then had to sort of take that back. So I think you're right.
Well, you said it's true, Joe. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Dan.
But I also think that it's how we look at science, right? I mean, we want science to be like religion, right? Religion tells us that there is truth and it is immutable, right? Science does not work that way. Science is the process of trying to understand the universe, and by its nature, it's going to change. So as studies come out on different vaccines, then you realize that things have to change. You might need a booster shot. This might come into play. But the public out there who doesn't understand this, or who listen to people who deify people like Tony Fauci. Now, don't get me wrong. I think Tony Fauci's a hero. But he's a scientist. And sometimes things on the ground change, and science adjusts according to the facts. But it's not like, you know, thou shalt not kill. It's not one of the Ten Commandments.
Not a definitive.
It's something that has to be, studied and reached, and it changes.
We got this from Lisa. There's been a lot of discussion about employers mandating employees to get vaccine. Mm-hmm. There's no discussion about employers not being vaccinated. I work in a little shop in a tourist trap town. We no longer require masks, and my unvaccinated employer wears her mask on her wrist. So suggestions, please? Yeah, that's tough. Bob says the severe eating of crow is coming down the pike. Fox Entertainment is reversing its language and speech from their mouthpieces about vaccinations. It's too tragic to enjoy their falling apart since it resulted in so much unnecessary death. Well, and I think this gets back to what Alan was saying. I mean, how do you reverse it, especially once you've started it and you realize that the numbers are climbing and we could be in a, I hope we're not, but we could be in a very different position in just a couple of months. Deborah says, Cuomo also assured New Yorkers that New York State would separately assess the safety of the vaccines prior to distribution. Then he messed up the distribution part by ignoring the plans of the counties. Go to Jules. It all comes back to Trump. Trump spewed division and misinformation from day one. Is it any wonder that Democrats doubted the fast vaccine development project that Trump was hyping, especially since it was also accompanied by Trump's recommendations of hydroxychloroquine and injection of bleach? I mean, there is that, right? There is. I mean, I think that's what a lot of the Democratic politicians were responding to.
Yeah, but there was no evidence when they were saying those things that the FDA process was corrupted, right? People may have had suspicions, but again, it's the same vaccines. It's the process that led to what we have now. So, if you're gonna say you were skeptical then, but you're not skeptical now, I'm not sure how that makes that much sense, unless you think that Biden came in and gave the. I mean the. They were approved before Biden even. They were on the market, and people were getting them before Biden even came in.
But at the time that those derogatory remarks from Democrats was coming out was after the president was doing regular briefings, coming out and saying, "Well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe it's hydroxychloroquine, maybe it's
The ones I read from Cuomo were mid-November. Right?
Yeah,
it was pretty late in the process. I don't know what Trump was saying at that point. It didn't really matter. I think by that point he was totally focused on the election, election lie and contesting that.
The pouting period, right?
The stages of election loss.
That's right.
Pouting, denial.
Mike says the socio-political dynamics surrounding COVID are interesting, but there are some common threads on both sides of the political spectrum. The need to create heroes and villains out of prominent public figures managing the response to the virus. Case in point, Dr. Fauci. People on the right have decided, rightly or wrongly, it doesn't matter that they don't trust Dr. Fauci. For this reason alone, Biden should name somebody else as the new face of our COVID response. Consider it a rebranding exercise. Thank Dr. Fauci for his hard work and let him go on to the next Bezos space flight or something.
Okay. To which I would respond over my dead body. I think this guy is fabulous, and I think his ability to stand up before some very hostile United States senators and give it back to them correctly is exactly what we need in this country. I wouldn't touch him.
Tony asked that very question. Did anyone see the very heated and welcome exchange between Dr. Fauci and Senator Rand Paul yesterday? While he was testifying on Capitol Hill, Fauci took off the gloves and really excoriated the senator as to his folly and ignorant rhetoric about the virus and its origin. It was very interesting and lent a glimmer of hope that not all have drunk the Kool-Aid. Then Kevin said, I work for an office supply company as a delivery truck driver, and I can tell you there are a good number of people in my position who have not and will not get the vaccine. It's political, plain and simple. It doesn't matter if Trump got it in January or not. It's a thumb in the eye at liberals, and that's it, no matter how many people get sick or die. That from Kevin. Donna says, I believe that Kamala Harris said she would trust this. As I should note that the subject line on this is Chris is wrong, but anyway. I believe that Kamala Harris said that she would trust the vaccine if Dr. Fauci said it was okay. All right.
Okay.
Chris is nodding. All right.
I don't have any way to look it up right now.
Okay. Doreen says, while vaccines may be the only way out of this, the message doesn't seem to be getting through to everyone. Here in Dutchess County, the completed vaccine dose is around 53%, up only 3% in 1 month, period. At that rate, the active cases will continue to rise. And that is a number that's pretty much being replicated across the state. We're seeing that. The numbers may be off by a percentage or two. Yes, Dan.
Joe, just down the street from the studios of WAMC at the Cultural and Foreign Community Engagement Center, where CBL has its headquarters, today there is a vaccine clinic going on. And John McDonald, our local assemblyman, who is also a pharmacist, is collaborating with us and providing the vaccines. And we are finding that even though vaccines have been available at the Times Union Center, they're available at CVS's, at Walgreens, they're ubiquitous almost now. People still want to come to a place that they trust to get this vaccine. And I think that's going to be where the heavy lift occurs. And government needs to provide as much funding as possible to grassroots organizations to provide the service, because they're the ones who are going to be able to overcome. And I'll tell you what, and I've seen cases where our executive director Mickey Jimenez, who's at the former church at the center almost every day, people have reached out to her on other matters, and she's been there and she's provided resources, etc. Those same people are coming back and said, you know, if you tell me that this is safe, I'm gonna get vaccinated. And this is with all the public messaging and all of the things that you see on social media. They still want somebody who they can trust, and that will make the difference. And I think that really, and it's not something that hasn't been said already, but there really needs to be a focus on that approach, in my opinion.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I was saying earlier that this is about largely a lack of trust. And maybe if you distributed, as Dan said, in places that people that are closer to them, maybe churches or community centers, places that people feel a little bit more comfortable, maybe they would. Places that aren't quote unquote institutional, maybe that really actually would make a difference.
So you think that the Times Union editorial won't do it in the same way as somebody you know well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Times Union. I think we're pretty much preaching to the converted at that point. I look at a lot of the messaging, and I think it's kind of it doesn't seem to target a lot of the public, campaigns. They don't seem to target the right audiences. They almost look like they're advertisements for the people who've already gotten the vaccine. I do think there has been a little bit of the messaging has been a little bit ineffective, and that actually goes back to getting these things fully approved by the FDA will allow the drug companies to advertise these products.
Right.
And they're better advertisers than the government is in most situations.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then, and they'll be better at targeting populations, and they may be more effective at getting people to trust it.
But to Dan's point, we have to go to a break. But to Dan's point, I mean, part of the Biden plan is to find prominent people in your community, go door to door, and offer them shots. And yet, the president is being excoriated for that, and saying it's a KGB approach of coming to your house and sticking a needle in your throat. I believe was one of the terms.
Yeah.
Social media.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's dumb rhetoric. I mean that's just an old fashioned way of getting messages out, going door to door. I don't really see how anybody could really object to that. I mean, neighbor to neighbor type campaigns are, I think, in the digital age, are kind of reassuring in a way. It wouldn't bother me if somebody came to me. I mean, if they were forcing me to get the shot, it might be one thing. But if they're just, providing.
Check them up, buddy.
Yeah, give me your arm.
They're coming for your Bible.
Right. All right.
I'm sorry.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on the subject. We'll get to those and other subjects as well. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, Dan Irizarry. We'll be right back. Go to letters on the subject of vaccines and concerns over the number of people who are getting vaccinated. We started off talking about a pair of stories. Oh, Dan's backing up.
Or someone's backing up into Dan.
Driving a tractor trailer as he...
It's a microwave. Calm down.
Oh, all right. Okay. Jeremy says vaccine efficacy is shown in the prevention of moderate to severe illness and death. Testing positive for COVID is very different from being hospitalized with COVID. Tests are sensitive to even non-contagious cases, and false positives happen. A breakthrough infection is a cat, and unvaccinated infection is a tiger.
Yeah, I think that's a hugely important point, because I think when the vaccine skeptics see these stories about people who are vaccinated getting COVID, they say, well, then why should I get it then? It doesn't even protect me. And it does. I mean, almost everybody who dies from COVID has not been vaccinated. It does make the illness much more severe if you do get it after you've been vaccinated.
Thea says, we missed our opportunity. Lifting a mask mandate should have been tied to vaccination levels. Valerie says, requiring a vaccine that doesn't prevent disease or reduce the spread of disease is not an effective way to manage it. Childhood vaccines prevent disease. Also, mRNA vaccines have never been used. That was all shouty caps. Been used in humans. So I'll wait for long-term studies before I would decide to have it.
Hmm. There is a lot of that. I mean, there is a lot of that. And that's why I do think FDA approval will mean something to some segment of the population.
Leslie writes, I'd like to see a return to requiring masks in indoor public places, requiring proof of vaccination for entrance to events, and insurance companies raising premiums for the unvaccinated to pay for the treatment of hospitalization increases. Give me a break, says David. Blaming Andrew Cuomo for vaccine hesitancy is completely absurd. Sure, you can cherry pick a small number of such remarks from the Democrats, but the gist of their advocacy has been in favor of sensible, science-based approach to the COVID crisis. Compare that to the torrent of idiotic, negative, and politically motivated comments issued by the former president and his gang. Please, says David.
Good letter.
Doreen says, while vaccines may be the only way out of this, that message doesn't seem to be getting through to everyone. Here in Dutchess County, the completed vaccine, I think I read that one. I apologize. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to James. Health insurance companies regularly deny coverage for necessary health care procedures. Are they covering the hospitalization costs of those who chose not to get the vaccine but end up in the hospital? Linda says, what are the stats on long-term effects of a mild COVID experienced by vaccinated people? So long-term effects of those who get COVID after they have been vaccinated. So
I don't think we know. We don't have enough science or information out there yet.
I mean, most people were vaccinated in February or March, so long-term effects would only be 3 or 4 months old for the oldest of cases.
Nevertheless, we do hear about people who were vaccinated who either got the disease or who are suffering post-vaccination.
Of course, you know, we also, back when we just worried about the flu, whether you get a flu shot or not, there were always cases of people getting the flu after getting the flu shot.
Sure.
So that, you know, again, it's not necessarily unusual. I think the messaging on this is tricky, because people that do not want to do something will always look for an excuse not to do it. So if the messaging is out there that I can get COVID anyway, even if I have a vaccine, it just gives them one more reason not to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think they just have to be very careful about how this information
is
shared.
Right, that's why I tried to highlight that if you do get COVID after being vaccinated, it's much less severe, and you're, you know, overwhelmingly less likely to die.
In the meantime, I got a shingle shot the other day. And the wonderful pharmacist, Joe the pharmacist, went down the list of all the things I might feel, and some of which I did. You know, I was tired and I was this and that. So, there are a lot of reasons not to take shots, not to take medicine.
But the truth of the matter is that if we continue to keep the message focused on getting the vaccine, the more people that get vaccinated, the less risk there is to all of us, even those who are vaccinated.
Right.
So it's really, the messaging has to stay on that, even if we have to continue to figure out different ways to get the message out.
And we also have to figure this, to me anyway, we have to also figure out, and science to tell us, do we need a booster? What is the vaccine that we received, whenever we received it, whether it was recently or earlier in the winter or spring, is still effective against these new variants? Is it effective against Delta? Is it effective against Lambda? And the more aggressive. And while it seems that as far as the Delta variant goes, that the scientists and the drug makers are saying that it is in the earliest stages of their study, we don't know for sure. The jury's not out on that. And we need a lot more data. Which, meanwhile, we're still playing this game of who should get vaccinated.
And Joe, quite right, but the companies themselves are adding a certain amount of dissonance to all of this. So you get Pfizer saying, no, we need to give everybody a booster shot. And you have the governmental agency saying, no, you don't. That's enough to make people scratch their heads.
Well, this is why we have to stay focused on what we know. What we do know is that getting this current vaccination that's available to everyone will severely reduce the risk of
Absolutely.
Everyone getting it. And so we have to focus on that until we get more science about the future, which is still in development.
I mean, no, that's true.
It takes time. I mean, we haven't had these vaccines long enough to really track this stuff.
Oh, let's see. We go to Carol, who says, I love the way that Tony Fauci lit into Rand Paul at the Senate hearing yesterday. Finally, finally, says Carol.
It was great. He was just great. It was a great moment.
It was great.
I agree that it was great, but to the people who are on the other side of this argument, that was just totally, you know, just underscored their mistrust. And Rand Paul, I'm sure, fundraised off of that exchange.
So do you think he shouldn't have done it?
To a significant extent. Do I think that Fauci shouldn't have done it?
Yes.
No, I think he had an obligation. Perhaps maybe less vehemently. I just think that we're in such a environment right now that these exchanges don't really help. I mean, if the ultimate goal is to get people to get vaccinated, I don't think this helps.
I didn't see the exchange, so I can't comment on that directly. But I do think Dan is on to something. I mean, if this is about persuasion, this is about talking to people, and if you just say, oh, you're stupid, or you deserve what you get, or really condescending to people, you're not going to persuade them. I mean, I think a little bit of charity and a little bit of kindness goes a long way in these sorts of situations. And I understand why people are frustrated, but on the other hand, you know, if you really want people to be vaccinated, just screaming at them isn't going to do it.
But the other way to look at that is that Rand Paul is spewing whenever he wants.
Right, and I'm not talking about Rand Paul. I'm talking more just generally, because I didn't even see that exchange.
I mean, I think that Fauci has been, you know, overly patient and strategic in how he uses his words, and he's put up with a lot of crap from a lot of people and has been very patient and held back. And I think this time he really just said what needed to be said. He was correcting a lie. He was holding an elected official accountable for not telling the truth, and I think that he has to do that.
And just to come back with Chris for a moment, who objects to using the words that I use, like stupid, where people might in fact not get the shot for whatever reason and die as a result of it. I think you got to make that plain to people that this is what is happening, and for you not to take that shot really is, stupid.
Yeah, but I just are you going to convince anybody by saying that kind of thing?
Some.
I don't know. Maybe.
Some.
Maybe, but that message has been out there for a long time, and it doesn't seem to be making a difference. I mean, I do think a little bit of charitableness would go a long way. I mean, if you look at the populations that have not been vaccinated, it's the uninsured or a major, the uninsured, people who don't have college degrees or don't have high school degrees, people who are poor. I mean, you know, it's very easy for the more privileged in society to just scold those people and shame them, but I just don't necessarily think that that's the right way to go.
Or right-wing Republicans.
Yeah, and which party is it that's making it harder for people to get insurance and to get a college education and to make a living? Which party is behind that?
All right, with those words, we'll let those hang in the air for a moment. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, and Dan Irizarry. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We just ask that the letters be short and to the point, and we will get to them in just a moment. Let's move on to other topics, please. We go to this one, a Trump fundraiser, Thomas Barrack, is indicted on a lobbying charge. The chairman of Donald Trump's inaugural committee was accused of failing to register as a lobbyist for the United Arab Emirates, obstruction of justice, and lying to investigators. Barrack is a close friend of former President Donald Trump and one of his top 2016 campaign fundraisers. He was arrested in California on Tuesday on federal charges of failing to register as a foreign lobbyist, obstruction of justice, and lying to investigators, as I mentioned. A 7-count indictment accused him of using his access to Mr. Trump to advance the foreign policy goals of the United Arab Emirates and then repeatedly misleading federal agents about his activities during a 2019 interview. That was just about 2 years ago, June of 2019. Federal prosecutors said that Mr. Barrack used his position as an outside advisor to Mr. Trump's campaign to publicly promote the Emirates' agenda while soliciting direction, feedback, and talking points from senior officials. Once Mr. Trump was elected, they said Mr. Barrack invited senior Emirate officials to give him a wish list of foreign policy moves that they wanted Washington to take within the first 100 days, first 6 months, first year, and then the end of the Trump presidency. All right. What do we make of this?
Well, first of all, isn't this how Rudy's in trouble, too?
And Mike Flynn and...
Yeah, I was thinking of Mike
what's
Flynn.
What's his name?
Manafort.
Manafort. I mean, it's a rogues gallery of foreign influence, isn't it? Oh, and by the way, there's gambling in the casino.
Well, the lobbying industry is actually, you know, very highly regulated. People often give lobbyists bad names, but they do work under very strict rules. There are requirements the government puts in place, rightly so, that say that if you are going to work in an industry that is going to try to influence U.S. government, you have to register. We have to know you exist, and you have to file the amount of money that you're spending on it, and you have to file the amount of money that you're receiving, and you have to file who's giving you the money and who's paying you. And those are all good things. It's what helps create a system that keeps things somewhat in check. He clearly has violated these rules, and it's good to see that government actually works sometimes.
Well, but the rules could be a little stricter, though, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Of course. They could certainly be stricter.
I mean, there is kind of a revolving door thing going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. But you know, the rules that are in place do serve a purpose, and they do help create some checks and balances. And so it's just good to see that they're working.
So does he go to jail?
Probably not.
It's also interesting to note that the nexus is like real estate, you know? Which is OG. Let me see.
Trump
the former president's, forte.
Mr. Barrack had hoped that Mr. Trump would name him to be a Middle East envoy or an ambassador to the Emirates. Prosecutors said that Mr. Barrack advised that such posts would empower the Emirates, and those in the Emirates agreed that Mr. Barrack could deliver more in such roles. But Mr. Trump did not give either job to Mr. Barrack, and he remained an outside advisor to the administration.
I wonder who whispered in Trump's ear that this is problematic.
This may be bad. Yeah. Well, and given what was allowed, you could only think, oh, well, maybe it was really bad then, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. So, I want to, Alan, what do you think? Do you think he does go to jail?
Well, you know, the fact is, you know, unlike everybody else in this room, I suspect, you know, I think there is a sinister political motivation on both Democrats and Republicans' parts behind everything. I think the fact that the Justice Department goes after him is an indicator that we're taking the gloves off. We, the Democrats, who have tried to get along with the Trump people, are taking the gloves off. Now, you know, you guys would be perfectly justified in saying this has probably been in the works for a long time, and, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, and you know how this stuff works is they talk to the person, and then, you know, you pretty well know that it's going to be coming. But I'm glad to see it because I think, you know, from the very beginning, Biden was, frankly, too nice. What, Chris?
Well, what you're suggesting is prosecutions as political retribution. I don't think that's something we should be encouraging.
Oh.
You know, that's Banana Republic stuff, and I don't think I think the Biden administration would be making a mistake if that's. I don't think that's actually what the case in the situation.
Right.
Because I would assume. I mean, we could probably. It's probably in the story, but. I would assume that this investigation didn't just start on January 19th.
As I just said, yeah.
Well, no, and that's another thing, isn't it? I mean, they started looking at the guy in 2016, I guess maybe even earlier than that. They questioned him in 2019, and then the indictment comes in 2021. So, it wasn't like it was a fast-tracked in any way.
Otherwise known as will they or won't they? And
right.
If you're it, you're sitting there thinking, maybe it's okay, maybe it's not okay.
The indictment comes.
I think it's a dilemma, right?
Go ahead, Dan.
Dilemma when you have people who've broken the law and right. they have to have been part of the last administration, and you're put in this. You know, I think Merrick Garland is feeling this pressure. Do you look like you're going after the Trump administration, hammer and tong, for political reasons, or are you just prosecuting people who broke the law? And that's a real conundrum, because you can start you can certainly see their right rallying around such a cause if, you know, Trump were to come out and say, oh, they're picking on my buddy. Although in this case, I think he probably has distanced himself for a reason. He knew it was coming. But I think that's a real dilemma.
Well, I do think you have to wonder if this person would have been prosecuted under the Trump administration. I mean, I wonder if you would have been.
You know the answer to that, right?
You know, it's. I.
You're wondering about it?
I think that it's somewhat naive to think that there aren't politics playing into prosecution decisions at some level, even if it's
Bill
not
Barr?
Admitted. I just think that your party does influence choices that you make, even if you don't want to admit it. Just like I think party influences choices that the Supreme Court makes, even though they say they're not political. I think they are political.
They are.
But Chris, but what happens when you have that dilemma, though?
That was Terry.
You know,
oh.
I'm sorry, Terry.
Yeah.
If you have that dilemma of you know, somebody just breaking the law outright and they happen to work for the last administration, are you just supposed to go, you know, we can't because of the way it looks prosecute this person? I mean, I think that the same thing might happen when the AG's investigation and when the prosecutors in the Southern District have to make, I'm sorry, Vance's office have to make that decision. Do they go for Trump? Do they go, if the evidence points to, you know, some sort of a plot to break the law, you know, do you not prosecute him because he was who he was?
Well, if
or
you
want
to
go because nobody's above the law.
If you want to analyze how politics may or may not play into decisions that are made in terms of prosecution and investigations, just watch how the situation with Andrew Cuomo plays out as the investigation ends, and the Attorney General and all these other people that are in a political position but also in a position that represents justice have to make decisions. Just see how that influences the decision.
I agree with you, and I hope we're on the same page on this one, Chris, because, you know, I'm always trying to put myself in the place of the Attorney General, who is, she must be saying, you know, if I do this, this happens. If I do this, this happens, as opposed to I'm just going to go straight with the law.
But I think it's better for her if she is straight with the law, right? I mean, I think if there's any hint that she isn't, that for her would be damaging. You know, I think this is one of those cases, and there are a lot of them, where doing the right thing is also the politically advantageous thing.
Well, you know what? You may be right. On the other hand, we're getting an awful lot of letters here saying, I love Andrew Cuomo.
Well, I would say, I would only disagree slightly, Chris, in that I think it's better for the citizens. It's better for the public that people in her position do what they're legally bound to do. Whether it's better for her or not, I think is a different decision.
I think it is. I mean, I think people, I think if people sense that her report is motivated, you know, that she's making things look worse than they might have been because she wants to be governor or whatever the Cuomo people are claiming these days, which, by the way, there's no evidence of any of that. But I think if I were in her shoes, the best thing for her is the best thing for the public, which is just be as honest as you can be. Do your job. Yeah. You know, the Cy Vance thing is interesting because you could make a case that if Donald Trump had never been president, he would not be being Cy Vance would never have looked into this and there would be no charges, right? Because Donald Trump existed for a lot of many years before he was president, and
gave a lot of politicians a lot of money.
Once he became president, once you run, you expose yourself at such a level that if Cy Vance were to ignore all the reporting and all the things that have piled up suggesting corruption, to go too far in the other direction, that would be basically saying that, well, because he was president, he can't be prosecuted, even though all of this stuff has been kind of laid at my feet.
He did the next best thing, Chris. He retired.
Yeah. Well, there's that, too.
It's funny. I forget who said it. One of the leaders of the Black Panther Party, I think, I can't remember who it was, who said, you know, we go after the guy who runs down the street and hits a woman over the head, snatches her purse. But when the government does that to poor people, it's just, you know, par for the course. What I'm trying to say is, you know, the criminal justice system treats people who have done far less in reprehensible ways. And then, you know, the reason why there's so many people who distrust the criminal justice system and government at large is because they see these inequities play out in real time. So you have a guy who can basically steal, because when you cheat the IRS, you're stealing from the government. You're stealing from everybody who, you know, rides a subway or drives on a road, because that's where our taxes are supposed to go. And you have these people who just commit these, you know, grand larceny. And you have guys who are, you know, spending time because they sold the joint during the Rockefeller drug era in jail, or kids who were accused of, a kid who stole a backpack and hung himself at Rikers Island because it took him 3 years to get a trial. I mean, this is the stuff that really shakes the foundations of faith in government and the justice system in, you know, poor and black and brown communities.
What do you think, Chris?
I largely agree. Yeah. No, I think that's generally true. Yeah.
We have some letters here I want to get to. These are mostly about vaccination, but we will go on to other subjects as well. Let's see. On Monday, the panel agreed on calling the behavior of people who don't get vaccinated stupid. This language is not helping and is actually what got us into this mess in the first place. Let's try to listen and talk to people with different opinions. Also, let's be very clear, anti-vaxxers are not all Republicans. There are also in our community, in the Berkshires, many left-leaning anti-vaxxers. But to know this, we would need to all start listening again and work very hard to talk and listen across the aisle. On multiple issues, we lost that ability, and also the panel needs to work on listening to people with opposite views and not only talk at and about people with other views. We go to this letter from Marlene. Dr. Walensky does not have a public health background nor training in crisis management and communication. I think maybe we're missing the importance of asking community leaders, family doctors, pastors, etc., with credibility to carry the message. I doubt going door to door will do much without the encouragement from credible community leaders. Calling people stupid won't work, despite the satisfaction one might feel.
Well, wait. I mean, you know, I have to admit I did use that word, and I sort of backed off a little bit on it only because it annoyed so many people. Nevertheless, when you can take a vaccine and save your life and save the life of your children, and save, what exactly is it? Brilliant that you don't take it? Come on.
All right, so one more letter on this. Calling someone stupid is never constructive. I know Alan is passionate about public health, but by calling unvaccinated people stupid, he is only deepening the divide. You can think whatever you want, but don't call people names from a fully vaccinated and very liberal person. Okay. There we go. We go to, let's see, we just have about 5 minutes before our bottom of the hour break.
So the name calling is worse I should back off.
No, nobody is saying it's worse.
Yeah, wait,
but,
I just haven't finished on this there, Chris.
All right.
So the name-calling, calling somebody stupid for not saving their life, is worse than what they're doing. Come on.
I don't know that anybody said it was worse. I think the argument is that it's it's not an effective strategy.
Well,
if you actually want people to be vaccinated, persuasion is the way to go. Listen to them, find out why they're hesitant, and then argue with them. I mean, there are some cases where it's not going to work, but just condescension and name calling gets people's backs up. That never works. It doesn't work in any situation.
I don't know about the word condescension, but I certainly am going to stay with the fact that when you have the ability to save your life and you don't do it, it defies description that will make all of these so-called finger shakers right. They're not. It's a terrible thing.
Anybody else? All right.
Staying out of this one, Terry?
Yep.
What about you, Dan?
Dan, you staying out or do you want in?
I'm staying out.
All right. Okay, very good. Let's go to this subject. I found this interesting. Dan, we'll go to you on this. Latino Americans are optimistic about the country's future despite being hit hard by the pandemic. This all out of a Pew survey.
Phew.
Latinos in the U.S. were hit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic on a number of fronts. They experienced higher rates of virus deaths and hospitalizations. They had more trouble making ends meet than other demographic groups due to pay cuts and job losses. They faced barriers to vaccine access. Still, Latino Americans are more satisfied with the nation's direction than they have been in a decade, according to this new data from the Pew Research Center. The report, which was published today and is based on a survey of more than 3,300 Hispanic adults in March of this year, illustrates how Latino Americans feel about their situations in the U.S. as well as the road ahead. Dan, does this jive with your experience, your ear to the ground?
Well, I think that it's to be expected that when you don't wake up every day to a tweet that vilifies your people or some guy riding down an escalator calling you rapists, murderers, and I think some good people, I think that might have something to do with the optimism that has broken out among the Hispanic community.
And yet
I also think, go ahead.
I was just going to say my question, follow-up question with you, or interrupted question with you, is, some people will point to the fact that a good number of Latino people have been voting for Trump and the Republicans. What do you make of that?
As every talking head on cable news has ever said, the Latino community is not a monolith. And I think that there are... And it breaks down along, the culture war type lines. I do think that many Hispanics are deeply religious. We used to be very Catholic. Now I think we're more evangelical than the Catholic Church would like to hear. But what that indicates is that on some of these culture war issues, there is a segment of the population that hews to the right's orthodoxy on these cultural issues. And so it doesn't surprise me. My family, I grew up, my father's a minister. I grew up in a very religious household. And part of my family watches Fox News 24/7. And I'm happy that most of them are vaccinated. But on all their culture war issues, I know where what they're sticking to, and it's that whole idea of the left is out to take our Bibles, and Biden probably has 666 on the back of his head, although we could see it because his hair is thinning if he did have it, I guess. But more to the point, and when you talk about the optimism, I do think that there is a general sense that we're not in the dark days of the former guy, and that there is reason for optimism. However, I would also suggest that while people might feel better, there are reasons to be very, very scared about what the future holds, because what's happening now around the pandemic is very similar to what happened during the mortgage meltdown. I know that one is financial wealth and the other is health related, but I think the effects are the same. I think you've had a tremendous loss of wealth among the Hispanic community. I think many of the people who were hurt during the mortgage crisis have still not regained. I mean, there are studies about this, have not gone back to what they had before. So I fear that this pandemic is going to set us back significantly once again. You know, that's why I'm really interested.
We have to take a break,
to
Dan.
See, but to follow up. I'm sorry?
I said we just have to take a break, so I'm gonna pause you there, but we'll continue when we come back, and then we'll do our last go-around. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday. It's Wednesday, the 21st of June, 34 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Dan, I had to cut you off because we had to go to the British people speaking. So what else did you want to say on the subject?
So I wanted to revisit the whole idea of what this pandemic has really brought to the fore in terms of the social determinants of health and how that has caused what the British person just talked about. Life expectancy for whites has decreased nationally by 1.5 years, and for Black and Hispanics for 3 years, so double the amount of reduction in life expectancy. So what I hope that local media, that people like WIMC continue to follow the idea of an equitable recovery. There was a lot of talk about how when we recover from the pandemic, we really need to keep a focus because this pandemic has shown us how unequal, medical care is in the community, how communities of color have been so drastically affected because of pre-existing conditions, et cetera. And there was a lot of talk about that. It was as if, people came to this, realization. Paul on the road to Damascus. Well, I just hope that we continue to keep an eye on how this works out in real life. You know, it's one thing to say great things during the middle of a pandemic and say, now we know, we didn't realize it before. What's going to happen after when all these millions of dollars that are flowing through the federal and state coffers and local coffers, is it going to be applied to the communities like the one I represent locally? Are we going to see some of that money go into programs and to resources? And that, that the jury's still out on that. But I just hope people do not forget the lessons of this pandemic.
Chris?
Well, if you watch cable news or read local columnists or pay a lot of close attention to the news, I think you can get the impression.
I love reading local columns.
Me too. but the news tends to highlight everything that's going wrong, right? And you get a sense that the country is kind of falling apart. But there more and more there's this polling showing that Americans don't really feel that that's the case. There's the poll that we're talking about now. There was also a Gallup poll which found that a record number of Americans say they're thriving, the highest they've ever recorded. They've asked this question for 50, 60 years.
I'm going to interrupt just for 1 second, Chris, just to say that there was one thing about this report is when we were talking about Latinos, just to remind people what we're talking about, but this study about Latinos being optimistic, that Latinos were also more hopeful than the overall U.S. population, with just a third of American adults reporting feeling the same. So
The Gallup poll says something different.
But go ahead.
But there is a counter narrative to all the negativity, is a point I'm trying to make. There's also a lot of polls are showing that more than 50% of Americans say we're on the right track, which is something that's kind of been a hurdle that has been tough to get over in recent years. Maybe I'm highlighting a little bit of a disconnect between what you see on cable news or what your local columnist writes about and how people are actually feeling. There is probably more optimism and hope about the future of the country than sometimes we make it seem.
It's interesting.
I also think if
Go ahead,
Dan. I also think that the whole discussion about, you know, the worth, the value of work has shifted, because the whole idea of, you know, the labor market being kind of in this precarious state. So I think you have optimism in the Latino community, because I think a community that was seen as undervalued for so long began to see its worth increase within the context of the pandemic. So now restaurants who used to pay people $2 an hour, right? Because when you work at a restaurant, this you're supposed to get share in the tips. So that's why you're allowed to pay people $2 an hour, which is obscene. And I had my brother-in-law was a waiter for years and years and years, and I know how hard that guy had to work. And now you have a shifting of the value of those types of jobs, because, you know, you can't get people in the door to apply for these jobs. And so now they're paying people more money. And I think in a weird and ironic way, these paradigms are shifting. And I think that gives people hope that, you know, minimum wage is going to increase here and there. You know, fast food restaurants are paying people more than they used to. And that's not a bad thing.
I think the poll also kind of reflects the optimism of immigrant communities. I mean, that's one of the things. Not every Latino is an immigrant, obviously. But, you know, one of the things that immigrants have always brought to this country is kind of an optimism and a hope. And that's kind of one of the things that's fueled us for decades and decades. And I think that poll probably reflects that.
I think on a political front,
I don't disagree.
Yeah. I think on a political front, this poll is really validating what I think both leaderships in both parties have seen recently, that they need to do better outreach to the Latino community. I think it's a community because of how large it is, and because of what the polling is saying there. It is really sort of fresh, unfarmed territory, I can't think of a better word, to reach out and grow their parties. And I think they're really up for grabs.
That goes
right
back
now
to what Dan said about the Latino community not being a monolith.
Right.
There are a lot of culturally conservative Latinos, and it, in a lot of ways, that points out the kind of, to use Alan's favorite word, the stupidity of what Trump was doing, because he was alienating a community where there probably are votes to be gotten. You know, the idea that the demographics is destiny and the Democrats are just going to sweep to victories in places like Florida and Texas because of larger Latino populations, I don't think is necessarily true, especially if you eliminate the kind of rhetoric that we saw from Trump.
Yeah, you're already seeing a shift in how Republicans reach out to the Latino community. I mean, you've been seeing it for a while, but I think polls like this are going to even increase that effort to really try to capitalize on the fact that, hey, there's a whole group here that seems to be happy, and here's our chance to really capitalize on that and try to take credit for the happiness and keep them happy by getting them into our party. I don't find the poll surprising. I think it's a good sign for America. I think it's a good sign for our policies. It shows that we are a country that continues to have the ability, even though sometimes we forget how to do it. We do come back to our roots, which is to reach out to immigrant communities and say, come be a part of what we have here and be a part of our country. And I think this shows that we're capable of doing that. It is the land of opportunity still. This poll shows that we continue to be the land of opportunity. And we also know that just looking at the dynamics of what's happening at both local, state, and federal levels, that there are more and more and more Latino individuals being elected to offices across the country. And so I think it's a natural evolution. I think the poll reflects that.
Speaking of election, go ahead, Dan.
No, just one last thing. I think this is a real opportunity. It's not exactly apropos to this discussion about optimism, but I think the Biden administration has a real opportunity to change the paradigm in Florida, depending on how they deal with, you know, the uprising in Cuba. I think there's a chance, there's an opportunity. It might be nuanced. The approach has to be nuanced. But I think there's a real opportunity for Biden to come out and do something. I don't know what that thing might be exactly, but certainly support the fact that the regime in Cuba is not, you know, meeting the needs of the people. But I'll leave that to better minds than I to figure out what that should be. But I think he, his advisors better seize on this opportunity to change the narrative in Florida, for instance.
So speaking, I think we have time for one more topic here in our last 5 minutes or so, and I would like to talk about politics and look at one particular House race in Cleveland, Ohio. Nina Turner's move from Bernie Sanders' campaign co-chairwoman to House candidate has highlighted a Democratic divide between impatient young activists and cautious older voters. Nina Turner has been out voting for or has been out campaigning in the 11th District of Ohio on August 3rd. The voters of that district will render judgment. Some indication of the direction the Democratic Party is heading toward the defiant and progressive approach Ms. Turner embodies, but it also is up against the reserve mold of its leaders in Washington, shaped more by establishment than the ferment stirring in grassroots. Democrats say there is little broader significance to this individual House primary contest, one that pits two black women against each other in a safe Democratic district that has been represented by Marsha Fudge before she was confirmed as President Biden's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Yet in the final weeks of the campaign, the party establishment is throwing copious amounts of time and money into an effort to stop Ms. Turner, a fiery former Cleveland councilwoman and Ohio state senator, known beyond the district as the face and spirit of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaigns, a co-chairwoman in 2020, and a ubiquitous surrogate for the socialist senator.
Yeah, this is an interesting race, and I think the outcome of it will really give us an indication of how strong progressive candidates from that very extreme left position like Nina Turner is, how well they're going to fare across the country. And it is an issue that the establishment Democrats are really up against. I mean, we're seeing them actually, for the first time in quite a while, put money into defending safe Democratic seats against Democratic primary opponents coming from that Bernie Sanders camp. And it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Let's remember that AOC remains extremely popular, I believe, in her district. And that there, that so this business, and also let's remember that Joe Biden is a moderate himself. Does he give credibility to the moderate candidate as opposed to the Sanders candidate?
Yeah, it's tough for him too to chime in on this. I think that, you know, his best move is just to stay out of it and let it play out.
Well, then the problem becomes that he has to put up with the slings and arrows of the left. And if he can show a victory here, he can say people are, you know, of his stripe are more sane.
I think he's going to have to put up with the slings and arrows of the left no matter what. I don't think that's going away. That's only going to increase no matter how elections play out.
You could be right.
Dan?
I think it's really generational. What we're seeing in the Democratic Party. I think, I'm not saying that every young person is more to the left, but certainly when you look at the polls, when we talk about, the young people think that socialism is a bad thing. It's not like, my generation, which was brought up in the Cold War. They have a different view. And I think even though these two young women who are running are, I don't know if they're the same age, but they're close in age. I think, is it Turner who used to be the Bernie Sanders?
Nina Turner, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Nina Turner is represents, that generational shift in the party where younger people are not willing to kind of, play it down the middle. And they're saying, look, we have to be bold in what we advocate for versus the moderate approach, which I think the Democratic Party decided to go and tack to the more to the center more because of the existential threat of the Republican Party in the last presidential election. I don't know that it was their first choice.
Chris, is it fair? I mean, I what struck me about this particular this story was that it sort of hit the papers yesterday. Everybody started covering it. It became a national story on this idea of it being a test of yeah, Joe I'm Biden.
I'm a little skeptical of that. I mean, in some ways, what's old is new again, right? I mean, Dennis Kucinich was elected out of Cleveland.
Right.
Was a former mayor of Cleveland, and he was a...
And running again.
Yeah, he was a pain in the rump for moderate Democrats for you know, many, many years. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not no expert on Cleveland's political scene, but... they do have a history of electing very progressive candidates.
All right, we'll end there this morning. I thank you very much for being with us. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Dan, thanks for being along. Chris and Terry, thank you very much. I couldn't see your name tag.
Love your name.
Chris, Terry, thank you very much for being here. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.